Welcome to the Issue Is Podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, an exclusive. We head to Pacific Palisades for a one-on-one with JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, the most powerful and influential banker in the country. We had a rare chance to sit down with him, first time we've done so. In fact, it was the first time he'd sat down with a local TV reporter in California in nearly a decade. We had 30 minutes with him as he saw for the first time the branch that burned down in the Palisades fire, progress on the new branch there. We talked about that. We talked about tariffs. We talked about Hollywood. We talked about leadership. We talked about a lot. So here is that special extended edition. Jamie Dimon, welcome to The Issue Is for the very first time. Thanks,
Alex,
so much.
Alex, thrilled to be here.
And welcome to Southern California. I know it's your first time in the Palisades since the fires. What goes through your mind when you look out?
Yeah. So the reason we're here is to come look at the Palisades, look at our branch, thank our people here, you know, understand the issue a little bit better, thank our people for what they did. We did a town hall this morning. It's devastation. We want to be part of rebuilding it. You learn what's going on. I think it needs a lot more work and a lot more help quickly. And it's amazing how some parts survived, and it seems so random in certain parts of it. And so my heart goes out to the people, and I want to thank the folks at JP Morgan Chase who are helping in the rebuilding effort.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the vault survived right across the street, and the people survived,
and
most
the
importantly.
The stuff in survived. I've been told that some of the vaults, the actually box survived, but the stuff in it didn't because it got so hot in some of the buildings.
What is your message to the people here?
Well, we'll have hope. You know, first of all, you're getting a lot of support. I mean, our hearts go out to you, but I think that all of America, when they saw what happened here, there are a lot of people working. You know, Rick Caruso is a friend of mine who I trust and respect, and he has his own. You know, he's starting to rebuild and help people rebuild from the churches to the parks to his own properties. It'll come back, and you know, it'll come back stronger than ever. And but it's going to take a little bit of time.
You're working with Caruso on this effort.
Yeah, working with him. We worked with him way before this, but yes, we're going to help here too.
And how do you think the bank can help California rebuild?
Yeah, so the bank has been here. We're now the number one bank, and I'm quite proud of it because we were not until we bought WaMu. We've been building branches and all over California. Now we're in retail bank, private bank, commercial bank. I mean, I got a number before I came here. We've lent in the state of California over the last 5 years close to $1 trillion.
Wow.
And that's a big number. But remember, that's not just big businesses. That's mortgages, affordable, we're probably the largest affordable housing lender in the country. It's small business, it's cities, schools, states, hospitals. So we have some of our top bankers here. We'll be looking at some of the things we can help finance here and help deal with the problems. You know, when people have mortgages here, credit cards, we do moratoriums. You know, we want to be part of the solution. And I think it's just important we play that role.
13 million customers in California,
I think we had 150 employees who were displaced. We were totally on top of that. We helped them all move. And I think in California, we have 18 million customers. And it's quite extraordinary.
In terms of a couple breaking news stories, as we meet, there's a new pope.
Yes,
and
I know.
It's an American pope for the first time.
69 years from Chicago, Leo the 14th. Yeah, I was just reading about that.
Your thoughts on that?
I think it's fabulous. Yeah. And I don't know him, but I think it's exciting to see after four votes, which I think is considered very few. And so we'll see. And I there's always significance to the name, so I'm going to do a little research on that after I leave here.
What do you think having an American pope means for this country?
I think you want a great pope. I don't think it has to be an American pope, but I think it's great that it is an American pope. And you know, maybe they can bring to the rest of the world some of the great stuff about America, and maybe bring a little bit here some of the great stuff from the rest of the world.
Yeah, and talk about deep dish, maybe. Pope from Chicago. Yeah. Other breaking news of this day as we talk is President Trump has made a deal with Great Britain on tariffs. It's the first major deal that's been announced in terms of his tariff plan. Your thoughts on that?
I am very happy it took place. I mean, I think, you know, the tariff stuff, it was very big and very large and everybody all at once. I think it's very important that they start to show progress in the deal. So any progress is good. These are deals in principle, so it's not really a deal. A real trade deal would be, you know, 10 or 20,000 pages long, but any progress is good. And if they can do the UK, and we got Japan and Taiwan and South Korea, the EU, which can be a little more complicated, and I'm glad they're talking to China. So I'm glad they did it. I don't think it's going to stop all the consternation about tariffs.
In terms of talking to China, that's supposed to happen this weekend in Switzerland with the Treasury Secretary. What are your expectations for that? What do you think a deal with China should look like?
Yeah, I don't really have high expectations for the first talk. I think usually the Chinese are very patient. It'll be, probably be more about parameters. I think if they do something, that would be great. And I think that would be great for both countries or something like that. But I think the first thing that America should do, these things get mixed up. America should do what protects our national security. That's unilateral. It's got nothing to do with trade. You know, and think of, you know, secure supply chains for penicillin, which we get 100% from China, medical ingredients, which we get like 80-90%, rare earths. Rare earths are not rare. They're everywhere. But they have the biggest and cheapest production. So if you're going to buy them, you're going to buy them in China. That's like 80-90%. Well, obviously, we need it to be somewhere else. Then there's things like AI, semiconductor chips, you know, things which can help their military, which is perfectly reasonable for us to not to want to help. Then there's what I could talk about, unfair trade. Mm-hmm. I would focus on strategic unfair trade. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't worry that much about furniture and clothes and sneakers and things like that. And so I hope they get to it and then have these serious conversations and where it's unfair to fix it, and then, you know, hopefully have a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, you've said before, you know, we don't need to fear China. We just need to get our act together.
That's correct.
And in
terms, but Americans should understand, America is the most prosperous nation on the planet. Our GDP per person is $85,000. Theirs is $15,000. Mm. We actually have wonderful neighbors in Canada and Mexico. We haven't been in a war with a neighbor since 1848. You know, they have a very complex world. They don't have enough food, war, and energy. We have all the food, war, and energy we'll ever need. Mm-hmm. They import 10 million barrels a day of oil. A lot of that oil goes by American warships in the Sea of Hormuz or the Red or the Straits. And so I think Americans should take a deep breath in this one. But yeah, we should negotiate what's fair and protects us. And so I'm not afraid of it. Their neighborhood, by the way, is very complicated. And they, on their own, have done a pretty good job scaring their neighbors. So they're starting to see, not because of anything America did, but they're starting to see their neighbors rearm. I'm talking about Japan, South Korea, Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, India. Mm-hmm. It's a tough part of the world.
Do you think that this overall approach to tariffs by President Trump makes sense?
I thought it was too large, too big, and too aggressive when it started. You know, it was a part of a master plan to get people to the table. But it's very important for your viewership. It's okay to say if it's unfair, we want to fix it. How you go about it, you can do it publicly, do it privately, you can start with national security. I just hope they accomplish it. I think it caused a lot of consternation. You know, if you walk up and down the street and talk to a lot of small businesses, they have no idea how it's going to affect their cost of goods. Mm-hmm. And those, it's not just they get them all from China, but, you know, there's steel inputs to that, there's all these inputs, and they want to survive. Mm-hmm. So I think to reduce the uncertainty that was created is a good thing to do.
Well,
and I'm glad they're responsive to that. They have been, I'm glad. And I'm glad that the trade agenda was handed to Scott Bessent. I think he's capable and competent, trying to figure these things out and try to do the right stuff.
And you let some of your potential issues with the original plan know in a interview with Maria Bartiromo. And according to the Wall Street Journal, President Trump watched that interview and then changed his perspective. You think that that he basically, do you claim credit for that?
I don't. he did watch it because he said so.
Yeah.
And, you know, he talks to a lot of people, and that I was just one voice among many about what to do next. And if it helped that, it's great.
So then if he's clearly listening to what you have to say, what's your message for him now?
Keep doing what you're doing. Focus, you know, when I look at it, the board has been successful. Mm-hmm. Okay, and after you eliminate the criminal element, I would try to work on a real immigration reform, which allows, we need seasonal workers, we need a path to citizenship for some of the undocumented but law-abiding immigrants, we need DACA, we need more merit-based, which I've heard him say all these things personally, by the way. So, you know, but once you have that border security, the American public probably would, he could be the immigration president. We've been arguing about this stuff for 40 or 50 years, and it's been a huge mistake. And so, he's been pro-business and pro-deregulation and getting this tax reform. Mm-hmm. Those things could be very good for the growth of the American economy. I would focus on that. There are a lot of other distractions that take place in this administration. Focus that on those goals, and the tariffs just make progress now.
Do you
country by country, tariff by tariff.
You talk to him much privately?
I do not. I would help any way I can, my government, whoever is the president of the United States. I I talk to a lot of his staff, so I have, hopefully have a very good relationship with most of them. And if I can be helpful with some, I'll call them up or go see them, and they come, you know, to visit some of the groups I'm part of, like the Business Roundtable or the Bank Policy Institute.
On the tariff front, as you mentioned, there's a lot of fear and uncertainty from average people, your customers, some of those 18 million customers here who aren't talking to the president regularly. How does this affect the average person's life? What should they expect in the coming months?
So again, let me start with what is important. It is important to get trade right. And you know, when you have a long-term goal, you know, it's okay to say it's gonna have a little bit of short-term suffering to get a really good long-term goal. So I'm not arguing that point. I'm not arguing there is some unfair trade. I don't think it's quite as unfair as you hear about. Mm-hmm. I mean, America is the most prosperous nation on the planet. The places that are so-called unfair trade have been doing much worse than us for 20 years. But I do think there are things around security. Certain things need to be made here, and therefore you need policies that make it, you know, semi-profitable to do that. But I think in the short run, you'll probably see a little bit more inflation and a slowing economy. That's what our economists say. I would guess that's going to be true. Just because of the uncertainty. And we see, you haven't seen the uncertainty in real numbers yet. You see it in surveys. Customer sentiment's down, business sentiment's down, what people say they're gonna do is down. But hard numbers, like unemployment, actual investment, I think you may see those start to slow down too. Hopefully it'll just be a very mild thing. And if inflation goes up, you know, you may have, the interest rates may not go the way the president wants, because everyone has to remember, the Federal Reserve does not set long-term interest rates. They set short-term interest rates. Long-term interest rates are set by people who buy and sell securities, of which, you know, there's buying and selling is like $30 trillion a day. Okay, and so, you know, if people think it's inflation, you might see the curve move around a little bit. But if we have a short-term recession, we'll get through that and hopefully get back on a growth curve.
I mean, here,
but to me, the most important thing, and this is, you know, hard to describe, we need to, America for the world is the indispensable nation. If there's no American leadership in the world, you will have a fragmented world. That leadership comes in military, where we are the military umbrella for most of the world who trust us, and we need to keep that together. It's perfectly reasonable to say we need our allies to pay a little bit more now, but we need to keep it together. And then economically, we are, you know, kind of the linchpin for the global economy too, and that's our financial system, it's the US dollar, it's the US rule of law, it's the, you know, our open economy. We need to have economic relationships like you just did with the UK. If you do that with Europe, you do that with Japan, you do it with Taiwan, you do it with Australia, you do it, it'll be a wonderful thing. So if the world, the Chinese and the Russians want to dismantle that world economically, and if you have economic fragmentation, what'll happen is all of our allies, every nation, will have to sit back and say, what protects my people economically and militarily? And it may not be what we like. So I that to me is the most important thing. What's the long-term strategic objective we're trying to accomplish here?
You know, here in California, we're home to the ports of Long Beach and LA, which bring in 40% of all imports for the whole country. They warning that their supply, say 6 weeks from now, is starting to gonna be less.
Yeah, I saw that.
35% down. What's your advice to sort of the average person on their own finances, on what the average person should be doing right now with all this?
I mean, that's a great question. I think the average person should do what we all do is, like, you should always be prepared for a rainy day. The economy is like the weather. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. So, you know, like we should teach them, have a rainy day fund, have proper insurance.
It's hard. Save. So many people live paycheck to paycheck.
I understand that. And I'm very sympathetic about that. You know, I think, you know, one of the things that we've done wrong as a country is that we've grown at 2% a year. And if you actually look at the incomes of the bottom 20% or so, didn't grow for 20 or 30 years. Under both Democratic and Republican presidents, with Democratic and Republican policies. And I do think that's a flaw. And that's about skills that they have. I would double the income tax credit. I would do a lot of things to help those lower citizens in a way that would have the virtue of bringing people back into the workforce. Jobs create dignity, jobs create better household formation, jobs create less recidivism. You know, jobs, if people have more money, they spend in their local neighborhood, so it lifts up the local neighborhoods. There are a lot of things to do, and my chairman that I wrote all these policies, that, and I said, without regard to whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that would make the country better off in the long run. And I think we should get on it. I think for too long we haven't been the can-do nation. We've just been, you know, with bad policies and ineffective government policies. You know, and you know it here, permitting, like just basic permitting. You have to have a crisis like this. to someone say, we need special permitting to build in the Palisades and Altadena. No, you don't. Mm-hmm. That should be permanent rules. And so maybe lessons will be learned to fix some of these problems that will make America a far healthier country.
We're talking with Jamie Dimon, the chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase. We are here in California, which is a huge part of your business. 17.4% of the whole business from around the globe here in California. Some $20.8 billion in revenue, up 10% since 2023. 16,000 employees here. What does California mean to your company?
First, we love California. I mean, when I come to California, you have a beautiful state and beautiful weather and beautiful food and the technology and all these wonderful things. So it's a critical part. We've doubled down on California. Like, we've started this innovation economy. My partner here, Doug Petno, is here, who does been running that part of it. We've hired 500 bankers to cover the innovation. So think of big tech, but now we're also talking about alt tech. So the venture capital companies, their portfolio companies, their founders, with specialty in, you know, in healthcare and food and consumer and digital and mobile and America is an unbelievable place, and a lot of it is founded around the universe. And you have unbelievable universities here, so the strengths are enormous. Having said that, every city and every state should not assume it has divine right to success, and should look at what it does well and what it doesn't do well, so you can make it work better. And so. So there are flaws here that need to be fixed. You're not driving out businesses, and hopefully the government will focus on that here.
I mean, what do you think are some of those flaws? Because there was this book that just came out, Abundance, by Ezra Klein, talking about the fact that a lot of the liberal policies, well-intentioned, are just don't make sense in the way that we execute. There's so many regulations that there's paralysis. What lessons do you think the state could learn from business?
I changed the name of red tape to blue tape because it's the Democrats who seem to want more and more regulations. We need good regulations. We need good food. We need good financial system. We need good. It's just not more and more. And you see it in everything, permitting and licensing. And there are lessons to be learned. And whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you should be saying, I want an efficient government. And you also have a lot of governments who they have never run anything. So our government, you know, the American people, Democrats, Republicans, don't think our government is efficient and competent. It's too abusive in some places, telling you what to do and what to think, and other places it can't get things done. We've been talking about fixing the FAA, you know, the people who do the air controls, for 40 years. Our
Reagan
system
era.
Is 50 years old. It's floppy disks. It's not the modern technologies which would save lives, save CO2, reduce accidents, reduce wait times. Why don't we do things
save money.
Like that? And we're crippled, you know, instead of being the can-do nation. So, yeah, I have deep frustration with that. And I think we need people and jobs. Like, even the Palisades, you know, if you want to get this built, you need, I would have a Palisades rebuilding building with everyone in the room, literally. I'd have it right here. I have sanitation, fire, police, roads, insurance, local, state, federal government in the room with charts. What are the problems? Because it's a huge management problem, and you know, government doesn't put, you know, top people who can run projects into management. It's too often politicians who were academics who've never run anything, and they, you know, they and that's a real problem. So, you know, hopefully we'll fix that too. And so,
you think Rick Caruso should be mayor?
Well, I love Rick Caruso. I think the guy is extremely competent. I'm not going to get involved in the politics or what he wants to do in the future.
Do you have a relationship with the governor of California, Gavin Newsom?
Not really, no.
No. What do you think?
But I don't avoid it. I just don't really.
He's not your guy. In terms of one of our biggest industries, obviously, is the film industry, which is also a huge industry for you all. 90% of debt for the entire film industry is financed by you, so, which is amazing.
Yeah, we have to make sure they're successful.
Yeah, I mean, and it seems like the film industry is really at an inflection point right now. Where do you think it should go?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm not. Last night I had dinner with a lot of studio heads at Amblin Studios, and it was really fun. And they're really smart. And from my vantage point, look at the content that gets produced. It's extraordinary.
Yep.
So I look at the other way around. So maybe the things are changing, and also the use of technology is extraordinary. But I did get up before I spoke to them a little bit yesterday, and I did auditioning. For them, saying, you need me on that wall. So I'm hoping that one day I'll get a little teeny part in one of their.
You've never gotten a cameo in anything?
No, I want a cameo.
Really?
Yeah, I do. Yes.
You're overdue for a cameo. But in terms of, one of the things the president was talking about this week is tariffs in terms of the film industry, or potentially putting a tariff for people that film outside of the country. What do you think of that? A good idea, bad idea?
Honestly, I heard about yesterday and even last night, people are trying to understand what it means. So I just don't know.
As a concept, do you like that as a concept?
Not generally. Yeah. I think the film industry does a great job and they film around the world. But I haven't seen the numbers about how many films have been done elsewhere, how many have been done here. You know, and there are a lot of subsidies that film gets in cities. I mean, if you go to New York City, I mean, you always see them filming and they get subsidies. And so I just don't know. I'd have to do a deeper study to have a real opinion about that.
What's your favorite movie of all time?
I'm going to tell you The Longest Day because I'm so proud to be an American.
I love that.
Or Saving Private Ryan.
That's another.
These films are just, they hit me like.
I love that. We're talking with Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. You have a management philosophy, or one of your edicts you've talked about is that complacency, arrogance, bureaucracy, and BS kills companies.
Yes.
So how do you stop that from happening?
So you go to YouTube, I put this whole thing up.
Yeah, it's really good.
I think it's like 40 minutes long, but I spoke for double that.
Yeah.
So we had to edit it to protect clients and myself. Yeah. I tend to emote and say things I probably shouldn't say on public.
What do you think are some of the top lines?
I spent time with the management team going through very detailed stuff, how you report, how you think, how you run meetings, what you do, why you go on the road. But I started by saying I'm going to be a little critical. You know, we got a little too complacent, bureaucratic. We're very successful. I said, so people say to me, why do you push so hard at these things when we're doing so well? And here's why. Ready? Sears, Kmart, A&P, Digital Equipment, Kodak. And I can go on and on and on. In each case, these were great companies. Complacency, arrogance, bureaucracy, management that doesn't get on the road, you know, doesn't wake up every day and put in the jersey and give it their all. That's why they fail. And I really do mean that. And so I think, you know, managements have to be fully invested. They have to understand their company. They should own the stock. They should get on the road. They should talk to clients. They should talk to their people. Even if we did a town hall this morning, and we, you know, we got two great ideas out of it. Things we, you know, when this woman was speaking,
what ideas?
I said, how long it took to do a special credit type of thing. And I was like, well, how long did it take? She said, it took so long. I said, well, that's wrong. We're going to fix it. So we've already delegated that. So if they're good, they would have fixed it by now. They may have called it in. But that's what you learn. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go to a branch today. I can ask our branch people here today what we could do better and get ideas. Mm-hmm. Then we can disseminate to 80 million, 5,000 branches, 80 million clients. So, yeah, management, you know, it's a bitch. But you got to get out there and you got to do it. You got to know the detail. Every small business person knows exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Every employee, every plate of food they serve, every, you know, getting the vendor supply, getting things in place, you know, having a team that works. You probably have favorite restaurants, you go there because now is the food good, but you know the waiters and
people, right? Relationships.
They got your drink ready when you get there. Exactly. It's no different for a big company, and it's hard. You know, it's hard work, but once you let that slip, you'll be a goner.
And what is your thoughts for young people getting into business today? Because it seems like that generation maybe has a bit of a different ethos than your generation. I know you've talked about the idea of like coming in to the office, how important that is for that. It seems like Gen Z thinks about things a little differently.
I don't worry about that because there's no Gen Z. All I know is I talk to kids coming to college and stuff like that. They're just as gung-ho. They always are the same. They want to change the world, make the better place. I did too. I still do.
Yeah.
You know, but you learn what that really means and what it doesn't really mean. We invented granola and tree hugging and all of that, but every generation, they start working, they have their own ambitions, they have their own purpose, they want to grow, they learn, they're going to see the world for the first time, you know, working as opposed to just thinking how the world operates, and you learn pretty quickly. That great quote, a young man who isn't a socialist has no heart, an older man who isn't a capitalist has no brain.
Yeah.
And they learn that pretty quickly. And you can still have a heart. I mean, I think, as a matter of fact, I talk about heart and curiosity in my chairman's letter. Mm-hmm. We want to treat everyone respectfully. We want a client who walks in the front to be treated respectfully. We want our employees, and they can be black, white, Hispanic, LGBT, veterans, disabled. We want them to contribute to this company to the best of their ability and say, I'm treated really well there. And they give me the tools I need, and they teach me the proper way, and that's what we want. And it makes a better company. And there are a million ways to do it. And that video on YouTube,
I give
a lot of very specific examples. Yeah.
And just broadly, as we start to wrap things up, a couple decades into this job now and dominating this space, what gives you the fuel? What gets you most excited?
You know, I don't totally know, you know, but I think when I can't give my all, I should pass on the baton or something like that. But look, I grew up, you know, my grandparents were Greek immigrants, mm-hmm. you know, and then you get these values from, you don't even know you're getting them, but, and they're not that different than values that you have and other people. Have a purpose. You know, that purpose could be building a company, being a great reporter, you know, being a teacher, being a mother, mm-hmm. you know, being an artist. It doesn't have to be what I want for you. Do the best you can, you know, and people feel good about that. Treat everyone with respect, you know, mm-hmm. and that means that's the waiter to the CEO, you know, treat people respectfully and, you know, try to leave the world better than you found it. That's my purpose. And this is my platform, you know, mm-hmm. to do JP Morgan. You know, we bank cities, schools, states, hospitals, individuals, 100 countries. Next week, I'm going to Paris and London, going to China after that. You know, we try to be the best we can while we're very patriotic. And so, mm-hmm. And we can disseminate best practices. And so, this is a fabulous platform. I love doing it, and hopefully I'll be successful for a bit longer.
We wrap things up with something called personal issues. These are rapid-fire things to get to know you a little bit better. Who is Jamie Dimon, the man? All right, so you ready? Mm-hmm. We talked about your favorite movie already. What's your favorite TV show?
Ted Lasso.
Oh, great choice. Who's your favorite sports team?
Well, the Yankees, of course.
I knew that was coming. Well done in the World Series last year.
When I was a kid, the Mets weren't there. So, and for my generation, to go from the Yankees to the Mets, you were a traitor.
Okay. Favorite athlete? Who was your all-time favorite athlete?
Well, it was Mickey Mantle for the same reason,
Favorite musician or band?
I love so many of them, but Bruce Springsteen, Elton John, Rolling Stones. I grew up listening to Vivaldi and Bach, so I like just about everything.
You run the gamut. Love it. What is your favorite Broadway musical of all time?
I can't remember. My mother, when I was a little kid, my folks over here don't know, my mother used to take me to off-Broadway Rodgers and Hammerstein singing plays, and Oliver was probably the first one I ever went to.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there we go. I heard that you guys...
Where is love?
Oh, we're getting singing now. Okay. I heard that you guys... I thought you were going to say Hamilton. I heard you guys have the original guns.
We do.
What's the story there?
I love Hamilton.
Yeah.
And Abe Lincoln and George Washington. And
That
they were purchased, I think it was in like 1932 for $10,000, something like that.
The guns used in the duel, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton.
The actual guns are used in the duel.
Yeah.
And we have replicas. We have the actual guns. And sometimes we ship around and put them on exhibit somewhere. When I first got to JP Morgan, I asked, what are they worth? And they said, they're insured for $1 million. I was sitting at my desk late one night. And I got a phone call from the guy who ran Sotheby's. He said, by the way, I know you have the guns. If you want to sell them, you know, we'll sell them for it. And I said, oh, what do you think they're worth? $30 million.
Wow. Yeah. You still got it.
It's probably worth a lot more today.
And lastly, you're so many people's role model in business. Who is your role model?
You know, it would probably not be business. It would probably be, Abe Lincoln. You know, when I think he's such an extraordinary human being. And then there are people like Nelson Mandela, who somehow was 27 years in prison and tortured, but came out magnanimous and wanted to save his country from what everyone thought would be civil war. And so I love to read history. George Marshall,
How does that shape, those men shape your perspective in what you do and in the way you lead?
I just read a book about Eisenhower and how he brought in the best and the brightest and how he made sure there were Democrats in his cabinet. How he would make the whole cabinet worry about all different issues. Mm. And he worked every issue and just unbelievably thoughtful management and leadership and respect. And then when he died, you know, all he wanted to do was be buried in an oak coffin in his soldier's outfit with just one, not an award, but just one thing on it, you know, very simple. And so when I read though things like that, I find their ability, their heart, their ability to manage difficult things, to get through difficult things, to not be confused by all the smoke and all the noise, but to stick to the principles and what they want to accomplish, to get people to work with them, to earn, you know, some of those people, every single person who's touched, trusted them, you know, and that's what you want. And, you know, and their purpose was to make the world a better place. And what they accomplished was extraordinary.
And lastly, how has your wife shaped your success?
Well, I probably wouldn't have been this successful without my wife. You know, I met her at Harvard Business School. Mm-hmm. I mean, she worked too a lot of years. She still works. As a matter of fact, she's doing some great work for the city school system in New York. But she also, when you're looking back, you know, who took care of a lot of problems and the kids and by your side for all the, I mean, I've had ups and downs. I was fired from a job at Citi. You know, she's been a fabulous partner all these years.
And as we say goodbye and we look out at this city as rebuilding is starting, what gives you hope? What's your sort of final message for people?
You know, driving through here and seeing the devastation, you also saw the homes that survived. You saw the trees miraculously that are blooming, and you're going to come back, you know, and hopefully you get all the help you need, but not just locally, but from the federal government to, I see all the construction already taking place. I know the Army Corps of Engineers is here, so I've got great, America is an unbelievably resilient place. I wish we were a little more competent, but it's unbelievably resilient. We will recover and grow and get better.
With a lot of help from you guys. Thank you so much for the time.
Alex, thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks for the master class.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Really
I appreciate it.
Our thanks to Jamie Dimon, and our thanks to you for listening to this special edition of The Issue Is. Next week, we take you to the Milken Conference, where we had an extraordinary opportunity to talk to a whole lot of folks. So this week was a one-on-one. Next week is a whole lot of people. Among them, we talked with Dr. Oz, the Secretary of Transportation, or Secretary of Education, I should say, Linda McMahon. We spoke with Frank Luntz and Nicholas Kristof and Sarah Longwell and California First partner Jennifer Siebel Newsom. We spoke with the mayor of Los Angeles, Karen Bass, Supervisor Lindsay Horvath, Evan Spiegel of Snapchat, Rick Caruso. All those conversations coming next week during a special edition of The Issue Is from the Milken Conference in Beverly Hills. Thanks for listening to this week's special edition of The Issue Is from Pacific Palisades. I'm Alex Michelson. We'll see you next week for more.